they do something here? It's Cristiano Ronaldo. Oh, it's a great cross, and it is an equaliser from Varela. USA denied right at the death.
Well, a heartbreaking moment for USA soccer fans when Portugal forced a tie in the last seconds of the World Cup game yesterday. Now USA goes on to play powerhouse Germany on Thursday. But after tying that game against Portugal and earlier beating Ghana, the U.S. has a real chance to make it into the second round. Paolo Bandini was at the game yesterday. He's covering the World Cup in Brazil for The Guardian. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So what was it like at the game yesterday, and what was the reaction among the U.S. fans at that moment?
It was an unbelievable atmosphere at the game right from the beginning. I think the U.S. fans have been phenomenal throughout this tournament. They're traveling in huge numbers. I would have to estimate there was at least 10,000 and probably more than that in the stadium last night. There was a reported 20,000 in the first game of the NFL. So they've been unbelievable in the way they've got behind the team. But actually, Portugal had a pretty good following last night as well. So it was just a full stadium, which seemed to have a really great atmosphere both ways from the beginning. And, you know, I felt for the U.S. fans last night because really that was a game that they, first of all, absolutely deserved to win. You know, they conceded a goal early on, but actually after that really took the game to Portugal, a team who ranked fourth in the world by FIFA. So a team ranked ahead of the U.S., a team who should have been the favorite.
Yeah, well, you know, I think going into it, most fans would have welcomed a tie against Portugal, as you say. It's a really strong team. And yet, when it was all over, I think a lot of fans, a lot of people watching were really disappointed and thought that maybe the U.S. threw the victory away.
Yeah, well, so I flew out of Manaus last night, and I was in the airport with hundreds and hundreds of U.S. fans who were all moving on to their next stop, so that was back home or on to Recife for the next game. And it was interesting talking to a few of them. There was this sort of general sense of, oh, imagine if we'd won the game, imagine what the atmosphere would be like in this airport right now. We'd be partying and having a great time, and we'd be through to the next round already. But when you actually got down to it and talked to it with any of them, I think there wasn't a single person who disagreed with the assessment that if you'd said to them at the start of this group, hey, you can have 4 points after two games, or even at the start of yesterday, hey, you can get a draw from this game against Portugal, I don't think anybody would have said no to it, because it's just a very strong position for the USA to be in. You know, they need to get a draw against Germany to guarantee their progress. Personally, I don't actually think they're even going to need that. I don't think that they're going to end up in a situation where losing would cost them in any way. So it's a very strong position for the U.S. And I think there is an awareness, despite the disappointment, that actually they've really outdone what most of the world expected of them in this group that was supposed to be the group of death of this World Cup.
Okay, so speaking of, let's talk a little bit more about this matchup with Germany on Thursday. And are you saying that you think the U.S. could actually win that?
I think it's interesting that Jürgen Klinsmann is willing to talk about it in those terms. You know, he had a press conference right after the game. Yeah, sorry, I should have said that. Jürgen Klinsmann, the manager. But he had a press conference right after the game, and it was put to him that in the past, in these situations, because at the moment, as it stands, if Germany and the U.S. do tie, both of them go through to the knockout stage. Now, Germany would be first, but the U.S. would still go through. And it was put to him that in these situations, in tournaments in the past, sometimes teams have maybe not shown an awful lot of aggression towards each other, and they've had results that are mutually beneficial, maybe not quite going as far as a fix, but just they get out on the pitch and they don't push each other as hard as they could. And he was quite strongly, you know, against this idea. He said he's not interested. It's not in the U.S. DNA, as he put it, to go out there and try and tie a game. They're going to go out there and try and win the game. And again, probably to a greater extent than with Portugal, the U.S. are the underdogs. Germany are a substantially better team than Portugal. Obviously, they beat Portugal very heavily in their opening game. They're one of the favorites to win this tournament. It's going to be a very challenging game.
Well, Jürgen Klinsmann is German, and he coached the German team. So does he have an inside track on how they're doing, and could that be an advantage to the U.S., and he'll know their moves?
To an extent, I suppose he might understand the way that setup works. It's been quite a few years since he was there, and the players have changed a lot. We're not talking about the same squad that he was in charge of. Although that said, Miroslav Klose is still playing games up front for Germany, and he's been playing for them up front since it feels like the beginning of time. So there's one or two that he'd be familiar with, and he definitely has a good relationship with the Germany coach, Yogi Löw. they, you know, they're friends, they've talked a lot. I'm sure that he's spent time talking to them about that squad, but I don't think it's necessarily to the extent that I would say that it confers a huge advantage to the U.S.
It was quite controversial when he decided, the coach, Klinsmann, to leave Landon Donovan off the team. And in retrospect now, looking at how the U.S. has performed in the World Cup, are people saying that that was, in fact, a good decision?
Well, I think there were different layers to the decision to leave Donovan behind. And one of them was sort of Klinsmann making a point that he was in charge of this group and he was confident enough to make his own decisions regardless of what the public opinion was. And sometimes that's an important point for a manager to make, to just reinforce that they're that kind of leader. They're a leader who is willing to make the brave decisions and is willing to make the tough decisions regardless of outside opinion. But I think there's also something to this idea that what Klinsmann has right now is a squad of players, a roster of players who just understand each other and have the same working mentality about how they're going to approach games. And he found 23 players who buy into his idea when it comes to that, when it comes to how to sacrifice yourself for the team, how much is appropriate to give in training, how much is appropriate to give on the pitch, and really fundamentally what you should be aiming to achieve on the pitch, whether it's about you or whether it's about all your teammates. And he felt, obviously, that Landon Donovan was not in the right mindset, was not the right guy at this point of his career to buy into that. And I understand why he did that as a coach. I think as purely looking at the talent and what he can offer you as a player, his ability, it was a surprise he Donovan left out. But so far, the way this team is playing really validates that idea that you've got a team that is greater than the sum of its parts. And if you have that, then maybe it's okay to leave behind one fancy part.
Okay, so if the U.S. makes it through to the second round, who will they likely play?
Well, if they finish second, it's almost certainly going to be Belgium, who are not necessarily one of the traditional powerhouses in soccer, but they have got a really good young team at the moment and a team that are beginning to look like they might be a dark horse at this tournament. So that would be a substantially tougher game than if they were to surprise Germany and win the group, in which case they might be looking at a team like Algeria, which is just a team which I think, or South Korea possibly still, or Russia in that group. But any of those teams would be a lot more manageable than a game against Belgium. So I think certainly there is an incentive to try and beat Germany and win the group because Belgium are a better team than anyone else they could play against.
Okay, look forward to Thursday. Paolo Bandini covering the World Cup in Brazil for The Guardian. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Daniel.
And I must confess that I have become a World Cup fan. I didn't think I would, but indeed I have. Have you as well? What brought you to the gospel of soccer? You can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or you can tweet at us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Speaking of the World Cup, you may have heard stories about how many English speakers are tuning in to more exciting Spanish language coverage. But the influx of a new audience has really nothing to do with the recent ratings roller coaster at two Southern California Spanish language radio stations. Back in April, a station that plays regional Mexican music jumped over four other stations to win the key morning drive time period. And then ratings plunged back down in May. Well, the people at Nielsen have announced that they're reworking recent numbers for the billion-dollar LA radio market, but that episode reveals particular problems with the way Nielsen keeps tabs on Spanish language audiences. Meg James is covering this story for the LA Times, and she joins us now. Hi.
Good afternoon, Madeline. Thanks.
Well, what exactly happened here with these stations, these Mexican stations, I think there were two, that experienced this incredible surge in ratings back in April?
Well, actually, we've noticed some pretty volatile swings in the radio ratings for Los Angeles on and off for the past year. And it raises questions about just how Nielsen, the big measurement company, which acquired the Arbitron ratings firm last year, is measuring Spanish language homes.
So what is going on with the numbers? And maybe you could just give us a little primer on how Nielsen measures the audience.
Well, I think the question of what's going on with the audience it hasn't really been adequately answered. Nielsen measures 2,700 homes in the Los Angeles markets. They provide adults and like teenagers in the homes with what they call a personal people meter. It's a little device that actually tracks the audio signal and can tell Nielsen what stations the person is listening to. And what's happened is that it seems like, and Nielsen hasn't actually, you know, verified this, that the number of Spanish speakers in their sample audience might be underrepresenting the Los Angeles market, and therefore a smaller number of the people in their panel, their Nielsen families, have a much larger influence than they really should have in the ratings outcome.
And so it turned out that just two homes made a big difference with those numbers.
Exactly. And that's why everyone is sort of shaking their head, because how can two homes in a sample of 2,700 have such a huge swing in the ratings? And obviously, you know, these are two homes that were, there were two homes, I should say, that were disqualified from Nielsen's ratings panel. The first home was disqualified because it was uncovered that Univision Communications, the huge Spanish language media company, a radio executive working for Univision, his family was obviously included in the sample audience, which is a big no-no for Nielsen. So they pulled that home out of the sample. And then the second home appears to be an immigrant family. We don't know too much about them. Supposedly they had a lot of these people meter devices, and they liked a particular station that features a Mexican immigrant name who goes by the name of El Mandril. And suddenly his ratings were, you know, skyrocketing. So when they backed this family out of the sample, then El Mandril's ratings fell back down to earth.
Okay. So even taking out maybe, you know, the fact that they shouldn't have had this Univision executive as one of the sample families, it does raise the question as to how just two families can skew the ratings so significantly.
Exactly, Madeline. I mean, that's the whole question. How can two families, you know, cause this much turmoil in a market as large as Los Angeles?
And so what are the hypotheses?
Well, the leading hypotheses right now, and the one that I'm sort of wedded to, is that when Nielsen goes out to find families, they have a particular problem signing up immigrant families. People are very wary of an organization that says, hey, we want to monitor what you're watching on TV and listening on the radio. It seems, you know, a little too strange to, you know, families who have not assimilated into U.S. culture. So what they do is they actually have a smaller number of Spanish-speaking homes than is represented in the larger population, and then they use a mathematical calculation to give these families more weight. So the theory is, if you are relying on too small of a pool of Spanish-speaking families to represent the whole L.A. market, then one or two families that have a lot of these meters might actually, you know, be able to swing the ratings a bit.
But other organizations have poll Spanish-speaking families and undocumented families all the time. I mean, public opinion polls, political opinion polls, things like that. And do they experience the same types of problems where they have to come up with some weighting measuring system to account for the lack of participation?
I don't think so. And I think the reason why this is such a big issue is because there's so much money at stake. If, you know, for example, if a political candidate, you know, tries to pull Spanish-speaking audiences and there's if they're a little bit off, then it wouldn't, you know, influence the expenditures of tens of millions of dollars, which is what we're seeing in the L.A. market, where we've had, you know, two, possibly 3 months of ratings, which were really highly volatile and therefore suspect.
Meanwhile, there's a separate but related issue, and that is that advertisers don't pay as much for a Latino audience, right?
That's right. At least advertisers are not paying as much for Spanish-speaking Latino audiences.
Uh-huh. And why is that?
That's a huge debate, and I would say even a controversy, because a lot of advertisers, including some major advertisers, tend to discount the Spanish-speaking audiences, thinking that they're not as assimilated into U.S. culture, and perhaps they don't have as much disposable income, and so therefore they give them a lower value, which might proved to be unfair. And I think the real question is, you know, who is the Spanish-speaking audience? Is it people who only speak Spanish, or people who can speak English and Spanish and feel more comfortable in Spanish?
Yeah. But meanwhile, there's this really coveted audience, and that is maybe the second, third generation Latino customers, and a lot of media companies falling all over themselves to attract that audience.
You're absolutely correct. Over the last 2 years, some of the largest media companies have been trying to figure out how to reach this young millennial audience of bilingual second and third generation Latinos. And they're turning out to be far more coveted, at least for advertisers, than Spanish-speaking audiences. And that's why you're seeing this discounting of the ad rates for some of the Spanish-speaking stations.
Meg James, media reporter for the Los Angeles Times.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, 50,000 children tried to cross the border from Central America in recent months. We'll find out how immigration authorities are handling this influx next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Madeline Brandon. You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. There's been a surge in undocumented, unaccompanied children crossing the U.S. border recently. The numbers are so big, the situation has been called a humanitarian crisis. Border Patrol does not have the resources to detain the 50,000 unaccompanied minors who've come since late last year. So on Friday, the Obama administration stepped in and announced tougher border policies to try to curb the flow. Meanwhile, temporary shelters have popped up all over the Southwest, including in California, to house and feed some of the new arrivals. And to give us a look at the situation, Elizabeth Camarena joins us. She's Associate Director of Casa Cornelia Law Center in San Diego, which provides legal services to children in San Diego shelters. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, the biggest number of undocumented immigrants crossing the border have usually come from Mexico, but the recent surge, we see children coming from places like El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. And what's driving this exodus?
Well, we have been representing children in San Diego County in the immigration courts for about approximately 11 years. And for the past 3 years, we have seen a huge surge in children. For the most part, they have always been Central American children, as those are the ones that actually are detained and put through the unaccompanied shelters that we have throughout the country.
Why are they unaccompanied? Why aren't they with their parents?
In the past 5 years, we have seen a great shift in the profile of the child that is coming unaccompanied. And let's say 10 years ago, we were seeing a lot, the profile was males between the ages of 15 to 17 coming in, you know, for the most part in search of a relative that was in the United States, usually parents, or work opportunities. Now we have seen that profile drastically change, and it has been shifting for about 3 years now. We have seen more children coming that are younger, more females, and siblings. And I believe that that the driving force is really seeking a safe place to live.
So they're facing increased violence in their hometowns?
That is our understanding. Most of the children, we do talk to them one-on-one. We provide consultation, immigration consultation, because all of these children are being placed in removal proceedings. So they do need advice and counsel of an attorney. And we provide the service free of charge to the children. And are the stories that we hear, for increasingly, they are fleeing violence. Not only violence in the home, violence in the neighborhoods and in the country as a whole, where they are finding less and less security in their person.
How old are these kids, typically?
Typically, like I said, about 5 years ago, you would find a male between the ages of 14 to 17. Nowadays, we're seeing children as young as 9, 10, both female and males. And once a family has been targeted by either criminal groups, cartels, or gangs, essentially the whole family is at risk. And so the parents or the guardians who are taking care of these children make the difficult decision to send the children north.
Yes, I can't imagine a nine-year-old traveling all by him or herself. So when they get here and let's say they're apprehended, what happens next?
They are apprehended typically by Border Patrol. The Border Patrol agents have 72 hours to place these children in shelters in an environment where it's conducive to the best interest of the child. And those have been the longer-term shelters that are running out of capacity, really, with the surge in the children that are coming. Thereafter, the children are placed in either what you call a long-term facility or a short-term facility, depending on where this child is going, where are they seeking, and then they categorize these children with potential for sponsorship out of the detention facilities. And depending on the category, the child will be sponsored out of detention to a family member, a family friend, or a Good Samaritan that decides that they want to assist this child.
So like a foster situation?
For the most part, we don't have readily available foster care facilities in the United States, especially in California. We have very limited resources and beds, as they call them, in the long-term foster care. But yes, definitely some of these children do go into these long-term foster care facilities.
So tell us more about what it's like living in these shelters, because I've heard some horror stories.
Fortunately, in California, and it has been our experience at Casa Cornelia, that the shelter facilities are run by compassionate folks that are really looking out for the interests of the children while they are in their care. Where we hear the horror stories are typically where the children are coming, just entering the country, where the Border Patrol agents may not have a facility that is very conducive to keeping a child for even 72 hours. And that is where I think a lot of the horror stories are coming from the fact that the Border Patrol agents are finding it very difficult to shift the children out of those temporary detention facilities.
So the Obama administration announced it's going to be detaining more, building more facilities, or at least contracting out to more facilities and stepping up its deportation process. How will this affect the children that are coming across?
Well, the children who are unaccompanied, we need to provide shelter, food, and basic necessities for children that are coming out to the border. We cannot return those children. So it might be something that affects the adult population that is coming through. There might be, once the children see that maybe enforcement is a little harsher, they might resolve to maybe stay under the radar, which might be a very dangerous situation for these kids, because these kids are typically Central American. They are not nationals of Mexico, so they cannot live in Mexico. They run huge risks with being kidnapped. We know that children have been kidnapped and taken in for ransom, taken into the human trafficking trade. And that is what we have been seeing if a child is not detected by authorities and placed in a safe environment.
So when they are deported, where are they deported to?
Well, the children have to, because if they are nationals of Central America, they cannot automatically be deported back to Mexico because they are not nationals of Mexico.
Right.
They must be processed through our system and eventually returned to their country of origin, wherever that may be.
Okay. And so I guess one of the reasons for this new policy is to deter people from coming when they see that there are strict deportation measures put in place or, stricter enforcement policies put in place, that this will deter migrants from coming. And that's mm-hmm. part of the reason, instead of adopting a different procedure where they would maybe just monitor them before mm-hmm. their hearings. And do you think that this will be an effective deterrent to people, especially children trying to cross the border?
Well, it's such a difficult topic to deal with because it has so many layers. You're dealing with a push factor out of their countries where if they stay, they face certain death. If they decide to leave, they may reach a safe ground. So the social, political, economic environments really dictate a lot of what is going to happen with these children. But for the past 2 years, the government has been aware that this is a trend. The trend is for having more and more children show up at the borders unaccompanied, telling us the same stories. So then, past 2 years, I have seen a preparation of the shelters that now are being put light on them, that they are being established throughout the country. But there has been about a two-year plan for these shelters to be established. However, now the urgency is that they did not expect, I think, the number to reach such a high level in such a short time. So the long-term facilities have been in the planning for about 2 years. The refugee-type camp that is being established in Texas, Oklahoma, and in California, in our Ventura County, those are, I think, they're just urgency and, like you said, a humanitarian crisis that needs to be handled right now.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much. We've run out of time. Elizabeth Camarena, Associate Director of Casa Cornelia Law Center in San Diego.
Thank you.
Coming up, kids need to learn their three R's, writing, reading, and arithmetic, but what about their C++? Why computer coding is being pushed as the new literacy for students? That's coming up after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and President Obama wants you to hone your hacking skills.
Don't just buy a new video game, make one. Don't just download the latest app, help design it. Don't just play on your phone, program it. No one's born a computer scientist, but with a little hard work and some math and science, just about anyone can become one.
That PSA comes from the organization Code.org, one of the groups pushing for more computer science in the classroom. Well, some advocates say learning to read and write computer code is practically as important as understanding the English language. But why? If we don't program computers for a living, why does it matter if we understand how our iPhones work? Tasneem Raja is a senior editor for Mother Jones, and she's just written about this for the magazine. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, some computer scientists have been saying that for a long time, reading and writing code will eventually be as important as reading and writing in general, the English language. So do you think that we're getting to that point or at that point?
You know, it's interesting to hear, you know, President Obama talk about this. There's so much focus in this conversation about is code a new form of literacy on the actual practice of writing code. And usually when people think about that, they think we mean, you know, writing software programs or writing apps. In my story, I put forward an idea that a lot of education researchers have been really excited about over the last few years, which is what if we stop putting the focus on code and really move towards computational thinking in terms of, you know, what can you actually do with code? Why would you code? What kinds of problems can you solve with code? In a lot of ways, knowing the answers to those questions is more important than, you know, knowing where the semicolon goes.
Right. Okay. So computational thinking, what does that mean exactly?
Sure. You know, in a lot of ways, there's parallels to a type of thinking people maybe are more familiar with, which is analytical thinking, right? So it's problem solving, basically. How do I take a problem and break it down into smaller chunks and then solve each of those chunks and get to where I'm trying to go? Or deductive reasoning. It's a way of looking at the world as a series of puzzles. And computational thinking, you could think of as a form of applied analytical thinking. It's a way of making analytical thinking work for you. So a lot of this work in computational thinking happens at the level of the algorithm. And algorithm is probably a term you've heard, but, you know, not a lot of people know what that means. Basically, all an algorithm is it's a step-by-step way of approaching a problem by taking a bunch of ingredients and layering them together, you know, throwing in some techniques and some processes and ending up with something else, something that's going to be useful to you.
So like a recipe, like you're cooking
something.
Yeah,
like a recipe. Exactly. And, you know, and in my piece, I talk a lot about how coding actually is pretty familiar to people, can be pretty familiar to people who like to cook, if you start thinking of in terms of the way a recipe works. So to start cooking, you need to gather your ingredients, right? And in coding, you need to do the same thing. Where computational thinking comes in is you have to think of the world in terms of ingredients that you can use. So that's data. You know, when we think of data, everybody's talking about big data. It's like, oh, it's the information that Google is collecting and Instagram is collecting about you. But actually, all of us are surrounded by data that we could use to do things more efficiently in our lives. So, you know, I want to know what temperature, you know, my fridge is, or I'm at work and I need to know how many tickets were sold on X event, and the program I have at work won't let me do what I want to do. So you can start by thinking in terms of gathering these ingredients and then applying some of the techniques of computational thinking to start doing what you want to do.
Okay, that sounds already really complicated and something that I might say, well, that's what I have an IT department for, people who are trained in this, and I would ask them to do that while I do my other job.
Yeah, the question is, how are you going to explain to them what you want? So knowing how knowing what computers can do, knowing what you can do with computing is actually half the battle, right? So, you know, we've all had that experience of we're sitting down to talk to somebody in our IT department, you know, a programmer, and it's like you're talking a different language. It's because they see the world in terms that the rest of us aren't really trained to do.
So you're saying we all need to learn that language. And not literally the language of Java or C++, but the language of thinking in a computer way.
Yeah, understanding the processes of computing more so than knowing how to do it yourself.
But you would have to know the basics of these literal computer languages to really understand the processes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In a lot of ways, this is kind of a two-stage process. I think that, you know, adults right now, you know, people who already have graduated from school, you know, have jobs, we don't need to learn to code. Learn to code if you want to. That would be great. It'll probably come in handy. But what's more important is to understand the opportunities of code, both so that you could start, you know, coming up with some new project ideas and collaborating with somebody at work. But I think more importantly, so that we start advocating for this kind of education in schools, so that our kids, for whom it's going to be more and more important to do this kind of work, we'll have an opportunity.
I read somewhere that some school districts are now saying, are now requiring computer coding instead of learning a foreign language. And a little part of in me when I read that died. I just thought that's kind of sad in a way, because it seems to be so mechanical in the sense and so utilitarian and I don't know if you can address that in terms of the functionality versus the romance of learning a new language.
Sure. You know, I think a mistake that a lot of people make when they think about computer science education is that it's got to be this thing apart, you know, that it's not going to have any relevance to other things you're learning in school. Like it's very much its own thing. That's why I really like a curriculum that's actually being worked on by researchers at UCLA called Exploring Computer Science. And the approach there is really heavy on this computational thinking part of the equation. So in this class, kids don't even touch a computer for like the first quarter of the program. It's about puzzles. It's about sort of detective work. And the curriculum will actually incorporate what you're doing in other classes to help you figure out how you might use code to solve some of these problems. So it's thinking about it in terms of an interdisciplinary tool. You know, we don't teach reading and writing expecting that you're never going to use reading and writing anywhere else in your life, right? Except, you know, in English class or if you go on to become an English PhD student. The idea is to give you a new form of communicating.
Okay, so that brings us to the controversial plan by LAUSD to put iPads in the hands of every student. And I'm just wondering what your take is on that. Is that learning computational thinking or providing the opportunity to learn computational thinking, or is it something else?
Yeah. You know, a lot of parents are probably thinking, my kid has a computer lab in her school. You know, she does her homework all online, digital book reports and so on. So my kid's probably learning what she needs to learn to take advantage of technology. Well, you know, using an app is not the same as making an app. Playing on an iPad is not the same as understanding how an iPad works. So, you know, there's a researcher I talked to at the National Science Foundation who had a great quote about this. She said, "We teach kids how to consume technology, not how to use technology." And, you know, it's fine for most of us to, you know, use apps that other people are building for us and, you know, find ways of being productive with them in our lives and our jobs. But every kid should at least have the opportunity to learn to go further.
And is that happening in school districts here and across the country?
Well, you know, in L.A., we have seen the Exploring Computer Science curriculum be taken up by LAUSD. And one of the really exciting things about this approach is that we've seen some research on if you introduce kids to coding via computational thinking, via the approach that ECS is taking, you actually end up boosting the number of girls and kids of color who both sign up for and stick with these classes. So there's, you know, a whole other angle of this, which is where there's so much conversation right now about gender and diversity in technology. And this is a program that's showing that, you know, you can not only teach these skills to, you know, kids in a way that's effective, but you might actually end up changing what technology looks like going forward.
So why is it that it's able to attract girls and people of color where other programs have not been able to do that?
Yeah, you know, an analogy that I use is Think about how you would teach someone to cook, right? You would never start a cooking class by teaching someone to sit down and assemble a KitchenAid blender. You know, you would never say, okay, let's look at the gears, let's look at the motors. And the student's going to be sitting there thinking, well, wait, why would I use a KitchenAid blender? When would I use a KitchenAid blender? So unfortunately, the curriculums that are already out there, for instance, AP Computer Science is the most widely used curriculum to teach computer science. These kind of take the KitchenAid blender approach where they throw you right into a program called Java. And Java is a heavyweight, complicated, very powerful tool. But unless you're a kid who's already drawn to computer science because, you know, maybe you had a parent who does this work and, you know, got you excited in it, or culturally, we know that white and Asian boys are more likely to gravitate towards this stuff on their own time than other kinds of kids. Unless you're one of these kids, you're going to be sitting there going, what is this? Mm-hmm. And why would I do this? Yeah. And you're going to drop out.
Yeah. All right. Tasneem Raja, senior editor for Mother Jones, where her article, Is Coding the New Literacy, is posted. You have to check it out. MotherJones.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
I am a computer. Hardly. Sometimes I wish I were a computer. I'd make fewer mistakes. Barbara Bogave is here.
You never make mistakes.
Never once. And you're sitting, it's so weird, musical chairs here. So you were sitting
in my chair on Friday. I'm having a mystical experience. Yes, talking to you across the table. I'm so glad you're not asking me the impossible questions I asked Warren. And this is an easy answer.
What's the meaning of life? There's one.
The meaning of life will be found on To the Point today.
At 1 o'clock.
When we talk about U.S. foreign policy in Iraq.
Ooh.
And the case for airstrikes. We'll also talk about how the U.S. can deploy these 300 special ops advisors and be involved in fighting this Sunni insurgency without coming off as being pro-Shiite. And we'll get into all of the complexities of sectarian
conflict. You'll
solve
all those problems.
Tricky. Yes. In one hour, and the meaning of life.
Excellent. Well, tune in for that. You don't want to miss that. You want to know what the meaning of life is. 1 o'clock, To the Point with Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney. And thank you, by the way, for sitting in so ably, graciously, and fantastically
for me.
It
was a joy. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, my pleasure. And coming up on this program, we're going to find out what Saul Goodman, our favorite dirty lawyer, is up to, along with other TV news next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time to talk TV. Your favorite shows may be all over, all done this season, but there's still a lot to talk about. Michael Schneider is here now to help us out. He's LA Bureau Chief for TV Guide Magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Hi there.
Hello, Madeline. How's it going?
Well, it's going great. So Netflix, finally we now know where Chelsea Handler is going. She's going to Netflix. And
yeah.
This seems kind of strange. She's a talk show host, and she's going to Netflix, which is known for its binge watching.
Yeah. Well, it's very strange because this kind of goes against everything that Netflix has stood for and has said that it stands for. And for the longest time, the folks at Netflix said this is not the kind of business they want to be in. They don't want to be in the live sports business or the talk show business. They're about binge viewing and these original dramas, as well as bringing old episodes, reruns of dramas that we loved the first time around. So this is sort of a departure from their traditional business plan, but it's kind of a reminder that ultimately this is Hollywood. Everyone's got their egos, and everyone, as they cultivate more success, they want to be in more parts of the business. And suddenly Netflix is calling itself a TV network. And they're going to find that it's tough being a TV network. You have a lot more failure in addition to success. And we'll see what happens with this one.
So they're ultimately in the business of getting more subscribers. So do they not care if the subscriber is just watching for, you know, one episode or two episodes of this and
yeah.
not binge watching?
Well, and I would say they're in two businesses. They're in the business of getting more subscribers and then bolstering that stock price. And so far, both have been working pretty successfully. That's allowed them the ability to experiment in other areas, such as doing a Chelsea Handler talk show. So already they've probably paid off this bet by just seeing their stock increase maybe in the past week. It's an interesting business, and who knows how long it can be sustained. But right now, that's one way that they're able to take these big bets, pick up multiple seasons of series, and of course, bring in a high-priced talk show host like Chelsea Handler.
Okay, another bit of TV news, this time from the Breaking Bad universe, and time to play Name That Character.
Final step, integration. The revenues from the salon go to the owner. That's you. Your filthy drug money has been transformed into nice, clean, taxable income brought to you by a savvy investment in a thriving business.
Love him, Saul.
We've missed Saul Goodman, and thankfully we're going to have more, a lot more. As you were mentioning, alluding to, AMC's just picked up another 13 episodes of Better Call Saul, which is a spinoff of course, Breaking Bad. The spinoff was supposed to premiere this fall. Now they're pushing it to early 2015. But in announcing that, they also announced that they're going to go ahead and pick up a second season.
Before even airing one episode of
the first
one?
So I guess that's a good sign. They like what they see so far. But it's also understanding that this is a pretty safe bet. I mean, everyone loves Saul Goodman. Bob Odenkirk is a great actor. So I'm looking forward to this. Now, I'm also worried. I think we're all worried that this doesn't go down the path of After MASH or Joey,
yeah.
Two shows that also were highly anticipated. That got
Joey underrated.
Joey was underrated, maybe. I don't know. After MASH, perhaps underrated as well. But we've seen time and time again these spinoffs where
right.
everyone, you know, just.
But then there's The Jeffersons.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was a good spinoff.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is a case of, you know, people just can't quite let go yet. They want more of that world. So the people who kind of miss that world will get a little bit more of it, although it's not going to be the Walter White world. It's still going to be a lot of fun, hopefully. So we'll see. I put my trust in Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad.
And is he involved in it in any way?
Completely involved. Probably even more so than he thought he was going to be. But he also has a legacy to protect, and he doesn't want to tarnish Breaking Bad, which was note perfect from start to finish. You don't want something like this lingering on and sort of tarnishing that a little bit.
Right. And so the idea of this is it's going to be a prequel. It's going to be Saul's life before he met Walter White.
Right. Saul before he was completely damaged by Walter White. So fun Saul Goodman, the Better Call Saul guy from the ads. And so it's going to be a little bit more comedic. Obviously he was the comedy relief in Breaking Bad. So this is going to be a lot more of that and sort of that world. So I think it's going to have a different tone as well.
Meanwhile, what are we watching on television? Because all of our favorite shows, Game of Thrones, Fargo, Orphan Black, Mad Men, they're all gone.
Yeah, they're gone. And so if you haven't watched any of those, time to binge. But in the meantime, there's so much coming on this summer. It's actually ridiculous. The Leftovers, which is the first show from Damon Lindelof, one of the co-creators of Lost, is coming on HBO. And it's based on the book. And there's a lot of buzz surrounding this. So that's coming up.
And what is this about?
So it's basically the rapture happens. And so it takes place a couple years after that. And it's basically the people who were left behind trying to figure out just what happened. And
why they weren't chosen? season.
Exactly. And also sort of, you know, people get back to their regular everyday life, but there is this weird sort of, oh, hey, remember all these people who used to be around? We still don't know what happened there. So there's that. Actually, his partner in crime on Lost, Carlton Cuse, has a new show coming, The Strain, to FX. And it's spooky. It's the creepiest show you've probably ever seen on FX. It's a vampire mystery. There's not a lot of levity on this show. So if you like your spooky shows dark, then check out The Strain. Extent is coming to CBS. It's a drama starring Halle Berry in her return to television. She plays an astronaut who returns down to Earth, but there's a mystery attached. She's pregnant, but she was up in that space station alone for 13 months. What happened, Madeline? I don't know. Let's check it out.
Alien. Okay. Speaking of crazy... Well, I don't know, crazy, but just bizarre. Should we say bizarre?
Speaking of alien babies.
Vice Media.
Yes. Nice segue.
Alien media babies.
I like that segue. Yes.
So apparently all these standard media companies, Fox, Time Warner, circling around Vice Media. They want a piece of Vice. And that's kind of strange because Vice has kind of made its reputation as against old media.
Well, I mean, Madeline, it smacks of desperation. It smells of desperation on the part of these big media companies. Yeah. They're all trying to figure out how to get that demo. Exactly. These elusive millennials who are not watching television necessarily.
But want to see Dennis Rodman in North Korea.
Exactly. And Vice has that kind of edge that, you know, the old timers over at Disney or News Corp or Viacom are all looking at and saying, wow, how do we get in business with these guys? They seem to have cracked the code with these pesky millennials. So they value the company now at over $2 billion. $2 billion. Madeline, this was a company that was founded a couple decades ago as a free news weekly in Montreal. Now it's valued at a couple billion. Time Warner wants it because they've got a struggling cable channel in HLN, which used to be Headline News back in the day.
Yeah.
No one's watching it anymore. They're trying to turn it into a social media network for millennials, but millennials, again, aren't watching TV news, so they figure maybe this is one way to get around that. So it's really interesting, and it's a good time to be Vice.
But why would Vice want to partner up with a television network?
Did I mention $2 billion, Madeline?
Gotcha.
That's nothing to sneeze at.
But it's made its name with these millennials, and the TV news watching public is a lot older.
The idea is maybe then you bring in the younger people who aren't watching any TV news and for first time get 30-somethings to actually watch TV news. Vice has a very successful and popular show on HBO right now, which featured the aforementioned Dennis Rodman going to North Korea and made a lot of noise, got a lot of young people watching, probably watching a news magazine for the first time. These kids aren't watching 60 Minutes or 2020, but they tuned into Vice. So maybe if you crack that code and turn it into a cable news network, then suddenly you get the young kids tuning in as well.
Here's another strained segue. Speaking of aging.
Yes. Speaking of alien babies. Sorry, I'm still on the alien babies.
Speaking of aliens and aging, General Hospital,
yes,
which probably featured alien babies at one point.
I'm sure they did.
Right?
They must have.
Okay, so it seems there is still an audience for that show, which is maybe 1,000 years old.
You are revolting.
Revulsion can be a route to ecstasy. Why do you want to hang out with that wet behind the ears kid when you have a full-grown man with experience and technique offering himself to you? No strings attached.
Ooh, that is Luke Spencer. Remember Luke and Laura?
He's still around. That's amazing. So
yeah.
There's some job security in being Luke Spencer.
General Hospital, I'm surprised, is still on the air, and its ratings are pretty good.
Well, there's only a handful of these soap operas left, so part of it is just the rule of attrition. Now that you only have pretty much four shows still on the air, you've got that, you've got Days of Our Lives on NBC, and you've got Young and the Restless and Bold and the Beautiful on CBS. That's it. Remember when there used to be like 100 daytime soap operas? There's only four left. So there is still an audience for soap operas, and they don't have many shows to choose from. So I think naturally you're going to see them sort of aggregate, and they're watching the ones that are left over.
But who's watching? Because it used to be housewives, and now women are in the workforce. So who's watching?
Well, obviously these days you can TiVo it, you can DVR it.
Right.
So we actually have more people who now can time shift it, and they're watching it either on their DVR, they're watching it online. People are finding new ways to watch it. The audience is the people who grew up watching soap operas and still are finding a way to watch them. Are still. It's a nature of this binge culture we're now living in.
All right. Michael Schneider, Los Angeles bureau chief for TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff, which is a free podcast. You can get it online. You can get it on our little handy dandy new app. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, alien babies.
she's not an alien baby, but she plays one on the radio. Julie Myers is here. Hi.
Hi. I'm not a robot, nor am I an alien baby, for the record. But I'm also not a World Cup convert,
Madeline. Join us. One of us.
I'm sure it's the best thing ever. And you were not the only one to become a World Cup convert. Fred from Long Beach called in to share his conversion story. His phone line's a little rough, but it's a good story, so everybody can just deal with it.
12 years ago, I was in Paris and had never really thought about soccer at all and was wandering around and happened upon the plaza outside the mayor's office. There was a huge TV set up, and the plaza was filled with people, and I had never seen anything that was so global. And ever since then, I've been hooked.
I think that might get me, too.
I know.
That sounds really lovely.
That sounds like so much fun. Well, this is what I like about the World Cup, because I don't have cable, so I'm forced to go out and socialize with other people, and it's really fun.
Right. He said that he went out every time they had a game, and they were always in that plaza. It didn't matter if France was playing or not. I think that sounds absolutely lovely. Another caller, listener Veronica, had this to say about the World Cup.
I am calling about the World Cup situation, of which I have become completely obsessed. I am from Uruguay, so I come from a soccer country. So, of course, I'm watching Uruguay, but I'm also watching U.S. and rooting for it. And actually, if I'm home, I'm watching all the games. So I'm completely into it.
So she was already into soccer, but she's become a USA convert.
Football.
She called it soccer. Thank you. She did. Saraya Lincoln left a comment on our Facebook page. She says she's become a huge fan of the World Cup, and it has a lot to do with access. She watches all the games on a free Univision app on her phone, so she's able to catch all the games she wants. And I'm not sure that was around 4 years ago, the last time around.
I don't think so. Okay, well, you can watch it on your phone, you can watch it on TV, you can watch it with other people, you can watch the World Cup. Come on, join us.
Or you can listen to Press Play. All of those things are available.
You can do all of it, all of the above. Or you can send us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. You can reach out to us on Twitter at KCRW Press Play or Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. So that's basically it. We'd love to hear from you and read your comments on the air. And that's out. That's it. I'm back and I'm out of here already. And Warren Olney, no, Warren Olney's not around. Barbara Bogave is next to host Warren Olney's show. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.